Hello, and good day from my side of it to all you in the room. First of all, I would like to thank the organization for allowing me for this presentation remotely. It's the first time in many years that I'm not physically present at the Open Society Conference, but I'm very happy with the opportunity that I was given to be with you. And at the very least, I am wearing something related to Open Society. So let's get going. I want to start by saying where I'm not going to start. I'm not going to start in Brussels. And for a talk that's mainly about European regulation, that might sound a bit strange. But I think that makes sense once you've seen the thing I'm trying to actually convey, and also looking at what the regulations are trying to protect. So where will I start? Actually, with where most of you already live, which is inside a Linux distribution and a package manager. And here's the thing, I want to build the next 30-ish minutes on, and that is that open source has already won the distribution. It did run. It's in the operating systems, it's in the developer tooling, it's in the cloud, it's in the AI stack, it's in the browsers, in the security tools, the databases, the public administration systems, the industrial products and the regulated services. Now, I don't think that anyone in this room needs to be convinced of that open source has actually won, because you build it. And the interesting question is no longer whether open source can be used everywhere, because it can. The question is that the next 10 years will answer if open source can be trusted everywhere. Now, this could have been an alternative opening, because to many, what the EU is doing basically boils down to a lot of alphabet soup instead of looking at as a coherent picture. And that is what I want to improve with you today. So, distribution and assurance, there are two different questions. Distribution is asking, can I use the software? And assurance is asking, can somebody else rely on it when they're under pressure? Can a manufacturer prove what's actually inside the product? Can a public buyer prove that it can move away from a supplier? Can a maintainer point to a documented way of handling a vulnerability? Can a regulator's operator show that its open source dependencies are known and monitored and also recoverable? And that is assurance. And assurance is a part of open source that we haven't finished winning yet. Now, the pressure to answer that question is coming from three directions at once. It's coming from incidents, it's coming from the market, and it's also coming from European law, from the Cybersecurity Act, from the NIS2, from the revision of the Cybersecurity Act, the Cyber Resilience Act, and from the Tech Sovereignty Package that we also have now since a couple of weeks. And what I'm going to give you today is a policy and an operational assurance perspective. So it's not a legal advice, but I'm going to try and make it as practical as it can, because it affects almost everyone in this community. So let's start when the abstraction becomes real, not in Brussels, but in the package manager. In May this year, a tool called GSD, which stands for Get Shit Done, became one of the clearest open source lessons out of the agentic AI era. And I'm going to be careful about how I tell this story, because GSD was actually seriously useful. It solved a problem that anyone working with AI coding assistants will recognize, which is under imitation called context rot. And that is the way the quality of an AI coding session degrades once the context window fills up. And GSD handled that by breaking work into phases and running each phase in a fresh agent context. And it worked well enough that by early May, it had around 60,000 stars on GitHub, over 100 contributors, and people adopted and appreciated it because it worked and it actually helped. But then the twist around it came apart. The original maintainer became unreasonable. A token associated with the project was publicly linked to a reported work pool event. The community forked the code to keep it alive, stripped out the token and the social links, and then republished it under a different name, and the original was lost. And that's the part where it matters, because When the fort was reviewed, the public review did not find confirmed backdoor in the reviewed source. So if your model of open source risk-based assertions is based on scanning code for malware, and then GFZ would have passed the test, but the tool did become unsafe to rely on. Well, why? Because the problem was never really in the code. It was around code. The maintainer had gone. The publishing channel was in question. There was financial entanglement that nobody had disclosed. So the real question stopped being, what's in this package? And it became, who can publish the next version of this package, and can I still trust that channel tomorrow? So this is the pattern I want to give a name for, because, we're going to keep revisiting it. And I call it the trust state inversion. And that means that the visible artifact still looks fine, but the trust relations around it have inverted. Maintainer continuity, registry authority, release, governance, financial incentives, who owns the package, who can push an update, and who has to clean up afterwards. Now, this already matters for an original or an ordinary library, but for an agentic AI development tool that can read your files, write your files, run commands, install dependencies, rewrite your code base, and insert anything into your log files, it matters enormously. Because the blast radius is not just the source code, it's actually the credentials, your user session, your SSH keys, and your CI/CD sequence. So GFZ is not a runoff. It's an agentic AI version of a lesson that the community already learned the hard way through ITSED, actually. And let's put ITSED next to it, because these two cases together define the project problem more completely than either one does alone. So the ITSED backdoor in 24 was a maximum security event. And it was almost by accident, by an engineer who noticed that his SSH logins were running about half a second slower than they should, and decided to find out why. And what he discovered was the end of a multi-year campaign. Somebody patiently building trust, sock puppets account pressuring the project single overwork maintainer into accepting a home maintainer, and then the backdoor went in. And the other thing about ITSED is that the malicious code was not sitting in the public source repository for everybody to review. It was actually living in the release storeboards in a modified build script that the attacker produced. And distributions often consume or rebuild release storeboards. So the attack didn't target the code that people read. It was sideloaded. And look at the two heads side by side. The ITSED artifact itself was poisoned. But in GFZ, the artifact looked clean, while the authority around it fell apart. So they point at the same conclusion, and that is what this home talk is about. And that's open source assurance is no longer about scanning code. It's about governing the chain of authority around the code. And this is also the first place I'm going to push back on a comfortable idea, which is that a software bill of materials solves everything. Well, it does some things. It tells you what components are inside. It's necessary. But it doesn't tell you whether or not that release tarball matches the source. It doesn't tell you whether the maintainer was compromised. It doesn't tell you if an agent has just added a dependency that no human ever looked at. And yeah, the question gets sharper, because AI tools are no longer just helping us write code. They really are starting to enter the dependency chain themselves. Now, let me make the shift from the old kind of dependency list to the new kind. Before agentic AI, your dependency graph mostly reflected human decisions. A developer chooses a library, adds it, commits it, and ideally reviews the log file. And it was never perfect, but it was at least a peer-reviewed path. Now, with an agentic coding engine, the assistant decides itself. It can recommend and also immediately include dependencies. It can write the install command. And in some configurations, it can run shell commands and write straight into the repository. And that means that the dependency graph can now expand inside an AI assistant session. And there's already a name for this kind of failure mode. It's called subswatting. And AI tools also sometimes hallucinate plausible sounding package names. As a developer, it's a great help, but still, you are in the driving seat. Now, there is an old line, often attributed to Bismarck, that laws are like sausages. You do not want towards them being made. And a close European digital policy B looks like sausage making. Consultation, dedicated apps, standardization requests, guidance documents, committees, negotiations, compromises, amendments, funding plots, pilots, and a wall of acronyms, CRA, NS2, CSA, SADA, or CADA, the CHIPS Act, the Open Source Strategy, Digital Commons EDIC, the ANISA Reporting Platform, the M606, the certification schemes. And if you're an engineer, it's very reasonable to look at all that and then conclude that the people producing it have really lost the plot. That the mess is not evidence of incoherence, it's evidence of asynchronicity. And the asynchronicity here has a cause, because policy doesn't move in lockstep, because reality also doesn't move in lockstep. Different crises expose different failures at different moments, and each failure produces its own instrument on its own timetable. Heartbleed, 2014. Look for Shell, 2021. Exit, 2024. GSD, this year. Cloud dependencies expose our strategic exposure to a handful of non-European providers. Chip and AI expose capacity gaps, and each crisis produces a response. And the way European digital strategy usually gets framed is a binary. Either you depend on American hyperscalers, or you risk exposure to the Chinese. And I think that's too narrow, because the stronger idea behind Europe's current approach is a third way. It's built on open standards, built on open source, built on interoperability, on rights-based governance, security, and competitive and interoperable markets that rewards transparency instead of opacity. Now, let's go through the dates, because some of it is already happening. The Cyber Resilience Act has been in force since December 24. Since June 11th, conformity assessment bodies have already started applying the machinery for notification. The reporting obligations start on the 11th of September 26th, and then everything comes together in December 27th. But do not wait for that. And clocks really are tight. 24 hours for an early warning, 72 hours for a full notification, 14 days after a corrective or mitigating measure is available, and maybe at the end, 1 month for a really severe incident. The point here is not legal compliance, it's operational readiness. Because to meet those clocks, you have to know which product is affected, which component is involved, whether it is actually exploitable in your context, whether there's a fix or a mitigation, who you have to notify, and what evidence backs your decision. So let's make it concrete. Imagine a vulnerability is reported in Curl or OpenSSL or Zlib or Systemd or a browser engine or a boot manager. Now the question is not just, is the CVE anywhere in components in my SBOM? The question is the affected code path actually present in the product as chip? Does my configuration make it exploitable? Is it being exploited? Have I become aware of it under the legal trigger? And what can I responsibly say within 24 hours and 72 hours? So, tying it all together and looking back at what we have discussed before, the landscape is coherent, but the instruments don't yet have all the same legal status yet. And that difference changes what you should do about each one. So the Cyber Resilience Act is binding law. You have to comply. NIS2 is directive, which means it's implemented through national law, and it may vary its implementation per member state. The current Cybersecurity Act revision is a proposal, and Cloud and AI Development Act and the CHIPS Act are also proposals. The EU Open Source Strategy is at the moment just a communication and a work program, but it's not yet a self-executing law. And the standards are also still in development. So why does this matter so much in practice? Because the status actually tells you what to do. If something is a binding law, your job is preparing and comply with that law. If it's a proposal, your job is to engage with Parliament and Council positions that are still forming and can still be shaped. So, I hope now that that's clear, the pattern is a bit easier, but we'll into that later. And also, learning is all about applying the three R's, so repetition, repetition, repetition. And this says, this is the slide that I really would like you to remember. So, let's build it up from bottom up. At the basis, capacity, the tech sovereignty package, the workmanships, cloud AI infrastructure, energy and open source, at home, foundational. And then on top of capacity sits product accountability, which is the CRA, which is asking manufacturers to place secure products on the market and to handle vulnerabilities over the lifecycle. And then there's the organizational resilience, which is NIS2, asking essential and important entities to manage their risks. And then there's certification with the Cybersecurity Act. And then there are the standards, the M6 family, and ESA's mapping work. And then there's procurement, which creates demands. And through every layer of those, there goes the evidence layer, which is S-bombs, provenance, advisories, exportability records, etc., etc. So, a Linux distribution is actually one of the most mature open source assurance systems we've ever built. But let's think about what it actually does. It takes tens of thousands of upstream projects maintained by different people under different governance in different parts of the world, and it applies packaging policy, it builds them in a controlled environment, it signs the artifacts, publishes them to repositories and mirrors, issues advisories, coordinates updates, and maintains the lifecycle. So, the policy world looks at open source as code in a repository, but code in a repository only becomes usable once you include it into something else. And when you include it in something else, like a distribution, all other elements become relevant as well. And here is why that matters for the CRA, because a large part of what the regulation and the standard are going to ask manufacturers to prove a distribution already does. The open build service is a controlled and auditable pipeline, and reproducible builds are a defense against supply chain exit type of attacks. And signed packages establish integrity. Advisories mapped to versions are exactly the downstream consumable evidence that the report industry needs. None of this was invented for regulation. It was built because the distributions learned the hard way that trust had to be manufactured, not assumed. So, let me give you a practical map. Because the single most common and most damaging mistake in this whole area is to assume that commercial use of open source turns everyone upstream into a manufacturer. It doesn't. A commercial enterprise distribution placed on the market under a company's name, it can be a product with digital elements for which that company is a manufacturer with the full set of obligations. But a genuinely non-commercial community distribution may sit outside direct manufacturer obligations, where it is not being placed on the market in a commercial activity. And a legal person that provides sustained support for an open source software intended for commercial use can fall in the steward role, which has its own tailored, lighter obligations. And a distributor makes a product available without changing its properties. An innovator who substantially modifies, rebrands, and ships the stack can become the manufacturer of that modified product. And a user organization may not be a CRA manufacturer at all, but it may still carry NIS 2 obligations. The story of how the steward role came to exist is, I think, also one of the more encouraging themes an open source audience can hear. So let me tell you about it before we go into it. When the CRA was first proposed in 2022, the open source community warned that, as it was drafted, it would destroy open source, because it would put all kinds of manufacturer-grade obligations on a community. But then in 2023, several foundations woke up, 12 in total, and published open letters to the European institutions. And they listened. With basically anything in Brussels, when you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So be sure to pay attention to what's happening in the regulatory landscape to avoid unnecessary surprises. Now, the political agreement that followed substantially improved the open source treatment, extended timelines, and created for the first time in any regulation a new category of an actor, the open source steward. So, just to point out, the community has already changed the laws once already. Now, hold on to that, because we're going to come back to it at the end. Now, what is a steward? It's a legal person. It's not an individual contributor that provides sustained support of open source software intended for commercial use and plays a main role in keeping it viable. It's not a manufacturer. It doesn't put a conformity mark on every downstream product. Its obligations are tailored. A documented cybersecurity policy, cooperation with market surveillance authorities, and reporting duties in specific situations. But that's a sort of point, and it comes out of the ECLIPSE and the OLC working group analysis. The text of the CRA can be as though a steward imposes a security policy onto a project. But real project already has security policies and governance cultures and maintainer practice. Real projects already have security policies and governance cultures and maintainer practices. So if a steward doesn't command the project, it provides continuity, coordination, infrastructure, communication, a legal interface, vulnerability handling support, and help with packaging the evidence. So the steward is a bridge, it's not a command structure. Picture a 15-person company, health tech or industrial automation or security tooling or data management. It ships a product built on Linux, a database, OpenSSL, curl, a handful of language packages, some containers, a CI pipeline, and now maybe an AI-assisted development tool. Under the CRA, it may very well be the manufacturer for the product that it places on the market, and its customers might be hospitals or public administrations or critical infrastructure operators. So this company has real duties. It must do product risk assessments. It has an obligation for a support period, vulnerability handling, technical documentation, etc. But it doesn't control most of the upstream. So some of those upstream projects are not commercial and outside direct obligations. Some have a steward with lighter duties. Some have no steward at all. And some are maintained by two people in their spare time. So here's the mechanism. And it's worth naming honestly rather than pretending that it can go away. If the upstream evidence is weak, this small company has to reconstruct that evidence itself downstream. Under time pressure, every single time something goes wrong. Affected versions, exploitability, fit status, advisory quality, provenance, release integrity, support pipelines, etc. That's expensive, it's brittle, and frankly, it's unfair. And this is exactly the mechanism which by unpaid upstream maintenance turns into downstream compliance costs, whereas a small company becomes the shock absorber. And I don't want to leave this only as a complaint, because there's an opportunity as well. Because if Europe gets it right, then that same pressure makes good SMEs more competitive, because a company that knows its own provenance keeps real evidence and, extremely importantly, supports the upstream it depends on, it, that company can respond quickly. And but that outcome requires the ecosystem to produce reusable assurance and not just reusable code. And it's more than an SBOM. So SBOMs matter because without an inventory, you cannot reliably tell whether a vulnerability even touches your product. But it really is only the first question. It's not the whole answer. An SBOM tells you what's inside. It does not tell you whether the component is exploitable in your context. It doesn't provide the artifact that came from the source. It doesn't show who signed it. It doesn't tell you whether the package namespace is still controlled by someone you trust. It doesn't show if the maintainer is still active. And it doesn't prove the tarball matches the robustly. And it definitely also doesn't solve the GSD style trust inversion. And that's completely an idea I want to give you alongside of it. And this is evidence in and thrust out. Whereas thrust is not something you assert, and the market is not really willing to just take it on faith. You need to provide evidence, because evidence goes in and thrust comes out of it. And the discipline that makes evidence worth trusting is already well understood in regulated industries. And there's another acronym for that. It's called Alcoa Plus. Any record should be attributable, legible, contemporaneous, original and accurate, and also complete, consistent, enduring, and available. And those properties translate the cybersecurity evidence almost word for word. But trust in the end is what's left when the question becomes, show me the record. So, as early as June of this year, no CRA harmonized standard has been cited in the official journal. They're not there yet. They're under construction. They're being written. And at the same time, the notified body machinery has already started applying on the 11th of June. But it still has to be treated as maturing. The single report platform is set to go live on the 11th of September. Now, I want to be precise about what it does and does not mean. It doesn't mean that CRA is delayed. It's not. You should be ready for it. So the vertical standards are in a mature draft, and they cover browsers, password managers, antivirus, VPN, network management systems, Steam systems, and book managers. And every single one is something a distribution ships, packages, or supports. So when the CRA's vertical standards are talking about a boot manager or a password manager, they're talking about your software. But I want to come back on the thing that I asked you to hold on earlier. This community has already helped shape the CRA once. In 2023, open source organizations did get involved in the policy definitions. And it has resulted in guidance, and we're working on harmonized standards, but basically the pen is still moving. So here's what's at stake. If open source communities don't engage, the standards that govern browsers and password managers and boot managers, they will be written around assumptions of proprietary boot manufacturers. Because when you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And the European organizations explicitly invite you to participate. So, which doors then to knock on? Basically, those are the standardization bodies, so CEN and CENELEC and ETSI. But there are a number of projects in place that you can follow for more information. So STEM for CR, STEM for Cyber, and CyberSTEM. And there's also the work of the Open Regulatory Compliance Working Group, and there's a CRA expert group, and they have open source representatives in there. ENISA is keeping track of the mapping of all the open source. ENISA is taking care of the mapping to see whether the existing standards are already covering the requirements. And there are already about 7 major foundations in open source that have joined the specification, including Apache, Blender, OpenSSL, PHP, Python, Rust, and Eclipse. Now, the most important thing is don't show up only with concerns or complaints. Show up with implementation plans and best practices. And standard bodies need concrete working models, and you have them. So, let me state the principle as bluntly as I can. Funding maintainers is not charity. And SUSE does a great job at it, and several other companies already also do it. But there are so many examples where the single developer in the Brasov or in Berlin or Zagreb or Nuremberg is the one that the entire internet relies on. And none of that funding or maintenance is exciting, but it's what the whole trust infrastructure stack is built on. And open source is in about 96% of all code bases, and it's a massive €95 billion contribution to the European economy. And yet, roughly a third of the maintainers are unpaid. We must improve. And again, we go to Germany because we have Schleswig-Holstein, the northern German state, because they have moved and they're in the process of moving into open source entirely. LibreOffice replacing a proprietary office suite, Open Exchange, NetCloud, Linux with KDE Plasma. But it's not just the software, it's also the file storage format. So ODF has become the administrative standard. So yeah, the relevance is direct. It affects components that... Now, for communities and stewards, the answer is not just to turn volunteer maintainers into compliance officers. That's unfair and ineffective. Just see if you can publish lightweight, reusable evidence that downstream users can rely upon. Make it inspectable. So, completely have a visible security policy, a security file, a security contract, and make sure that you also ensure release integrity. Have signed releases, provenance where you can. Make sure that you have component transparency, SBOM generation, and make sure also that you communicate vulnerabilities, and also make sure that you have governance in place for continuity. Now, for stewards, and there's this CRA bridge again on top, make sure that the documented cybersecurity policy also is being fulfilled with the evidence artifacts, and cooperate with the authorities and see if indeed reporting triggers are happening whenever an incident is happening or whenever a vulnerability is detected. So none of this is meant as compliance bureaucracy for volunteers. It's a trust infrastructure for everyone who depends on the project. You're not doing it for the regulator. You're doing it for the person three hops downstream who has to answer for what you fit. And for companies and organizations, the model is different. They have to build loops. For business owners and organizations, the response to all of this is not panic. And it's not a retreat from open source or from agentic AI, both of which deliver real value and are not going away. The response is professionalization, and it fits into four loops. One is the adoption loop. Write down what you are adopting, what it can access, who controls the registry, how releases are published, etc. And for a small company, it can just be a one-page intake rep. It doesn't need to be heavy. It just needs to exist, and it needs to be provable. And also it measured in the runtime loop when everything is actually executed within your processes. Make sure that you bin versions. Don't just pull the latest stack from anywhere. Just make sure that you know what is running, because as mentioned, the GSD is the one having the repository population keys can still produce new packages within the original channels. You don't know what will come in. And also make sure that you keep your secrets safe. Don't keep production secrets in an environment where an agent is running. So whenever a tool has compromised, it cannot escalate down the line. And make sure there's human approval. And also the response loop is incredibly critical. And this is one of the most companies simply don't have, because it really is new. A maintainer trust collapse playbook is not the same as a vulnerability playbook, because in case of GSD, there was no CVE, there was no expert. The trigger was a loss of trust in the maintainer continuity, registry control, and governance. So, know every place where the tool is installed. Inspect log files, installs, configurations in CI/CD environments. Rotate credentials often. Make sure that you are also not just having SBOMs, but CBOMs, crypto bill of materials. Make sure that you know which credentials are being used where. Know which algorithms and which cipher suites are there. Make sure that you are in charge of the whole pipeline, and then decide if a tool needs to be replaced, if it can migrate or fork or replace or retire. And also rehearse for that. Because what I see happening is, in so many companies, is that it's kind of similar to running a fire drill by actually setting the building on fire and then seeing what happens. So be aware of what runs in your environment and what can happen, because by the 11th of September, you are obliged to have your reporting pipeline in place. So the agentic control loop is another element to look into, and the role is not to ban AI calling tools, because I use them. The role is to treat them as what they are. They are privileged software production components. So adapt some sanity rules. No high-privileged AI development tools should enter normal engineering use without named ownership, somebody who's responsible for it, version pinning, privilege specification, and also sandboxing, and also make sure you have removal instructions in place and you verify them so that you can take the tool out within a reasonable time frame. Those minimum controls are not difficult. They can be applied everywhere. So, think about this in seven dimensions. Registry governance, who can publish, and do we know who's behind that identity claim? Release authority distribution, how many independent people control the release? Succession and bus factory, what happens when the maintainer is wrong? Financial entanglement, whether a token or rent could distort governance. Build and package governance, whether releases are signed and reproducible. Agent privilege transparency, what the tool can be, write, execute, and install. And dependency of autonomy controls, whether the tool can add dependencies without a human in the loop. Now, for a high-privileged tool, a bus factor of one should stop professional adoption unless you have documented compensating control. And a project with its own tradable token should be treated as a financially entangled supplier, not as neutral infrastructure. So the work is not only inside your own project, though. It's also out there where the European process is being written. So let me tell you what show up. The standards go to your national standards bodies. As mentioned, CERN and CERNELEC and ETSI in the Netherlands, they go through NEN, in Germany through DIN. And make sure you track both the horizontal as well as the vertical and sit-for-sit work. Bring your distribution examples and bring your experiences and assurance patterns. Now, for community implementations, follow and contribute to the Open Regulatory Compliance Working Group. Use and improve the steward guidances, the security policy templates, and the compliance resources that already exist. Now, for the public support routes, follow Stand for CR and CyberStands, which exists specifically to help open source and SME users input with CRA standardization. Track the CRA expert group and its open source representatives as well. And use the ANISA and JRC mapping to see where existing standards already cover the requirements and where the real gaps are. From crisis to capacity, from dependency to evidence, from open source distribution to open source assurance, GSD shows us that clean looking code is not the same as a trustworthy supply chain. Z showed us that a release path can be attacked even when the source review looks normal. And the European policy landscape, which may look like a mess of flows, resolves from orbit into a trust stack. Product accountability, organizational resilience, certification, standards, capacity, procurement, funding, and evidence are running throughout all of it. And here's the opportunity. Open source is uniquely placed to become the control layer of Europe's third way, because it can be inspected, adapted, ported, and shared. But only it becomes sovereign infrastructure if it's maintained, evidenced, stewarded, procurable, and recoverable. The license was never the hard part, the insurances. So the question over the next 10 years will no longer be, is it open? And can you prove trust under pressure? Because that is what assurance is. It's not a clean scan, because a clean scan is only a timestamp. Open source has one distribution because it could be used everywhere. It will win the next phase only if it can be trusted everywhere. And trust, when the question finally comes, is simple. Show me the record. Thank you.